An average foster youth moves around in the system minimum of 7 times, up to 20 times. Only out of the 40, I think it's 46% that graduate, only 3% actually go to college. Out of that 3%, only 1% actually graduate. So my thought again is, how can our kids get a better chance, a fair shake, right? How can they have a better quality of life?
Welcome to the Philanthropy Masterminds podcast, brought to you by DonorSearch, the show that takes you inside the lives of thought leaders, innovators, and changemakers in fundraising, philanthropy, and civil society. I'm your host, Jay Frost. Pamela Clay has been at the helm of Living Advantage for nearly 3 decades, working tirelessly to uplift at-risk youth in Los Angeles and Orange counties. Building on her mother's legacy, she has broadened the nonprofit scope, enhancing education, technology access, and career readiness to disrupt cycles of adversity. As the number and needs of foster youth grow and expand, Living Advantage's work is more critical than ever. Today, Pamela Clay and her team are providing a broad range of essential services to reduce the number of youth who face homelessness, joblessness, and incarceration as they transition out of the foster care system and into successful, independent lives that defy the odds.
You know, hello everyone. I'm so excited to be here with Mastermind. And he asked me what I like to talk about or what I wouldn't like to talk about. And I would love to talk about how we're going to make billions and billions of dollars to save our kids, to save the world. And what I don't want to talk about is not making that billions of dollars. You know, because guess what? We're going to save. We're going to save our kids. We're going to save the world.
That's the goal, right? It's not Absolutely. That easy though, is it? I mean, you've been doing this work for 24, 25 years?
Yeah, we're hitting almost 30. You know, if you would have said that to me maybe about a couple of months back, just recently, I would have said it's not easy. But you know what? I had a meeting with LA County Youth Commissioner, Executive Director. And I think her name is... when the beauty contest they put the what are the crowns they put on their head? What are
like a tiara or something?
Tiara.
Or?
Her name is Tiara, and Tiara oh. said, "Tiara said, one person at a time, one person at a time." So it has been very easy, actually. I'm pretty good at it. So one person at a time. Yes, it's easy. It's easy because you know what? It's really sometimes just smiling, giving people hope, making sure people know you care. At the end of the day, that's all you can do. And I've been very, very, very fortunate and blessed enough to be able to do that. So, yeah, but, you know, we want to go. You know how we are. You know how humans are. You know, we has to be $1 billion and we have to save everybody, right? You know how we are. That's just our nature.
Well. So. I'd like to think that that's our nature, but not everybody brings that amount of energy to it. So I'm in awe. But I want to know where it comes from, too. So do you mind if we peel back the years a little bit? You just said 30. That actually dates back to, I guess, when your mom originally founded the organization. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So a little history. Living Advantage pretty much came from my mom's background in teaching special ed kids in LAUSD, LA Unified School District. She did almost 30 years, 27 years, and she was a speech pathologist and she did special ed. So she primarily dealt with the kids that supposedly had a learning disability. And, you know, I'm sure, yeah, I was young. I was a super, you know, very young at the time. You know, I figure in my, you know, early, what do you call it? Like early teens, right? Mm-hmm. And I just used to remember she was always at court a lot. And I didn't understand how you know, being a school teacher, you know, and dealt with court, family court. And of course, as we got older, she would explain, oh, you know, a couple of our students, you know, had some family issues and they were going to court to resolve them. Of course, that's probably way before foster care and, you know, abuse, you know, child abuse is so prominent. You know, now you know, everybody, you know, at least hears about foster care. Everybody, you know, hears about abuse. And of course, a lot of people now that, you know, now that it's more open, people are sharing those situations. And so back then, it was really just kind of getting it kind of from the first hand. And so when I got old enough, I was actually pretty young. I was still in my teens when I started my real estate background. And I started out as a mortgage broker, you know, packaging mortgage or, you know, putting together loan packaging for real estate deals. And a partner of mine just, it was so random. He was like, hey, my family, you know, has group homes, because that's when I had started investing into real estate. And I was like, oh, well, that seems interesting. That pretty much the way he put it was like, they pay you to buy the house, they pay you to put the group home together, and they pay you for your monthly mortgage. And I was like, that sounds like a good deal to me. So I really got involved more per se in the investment arena of it. And unfortunately, when I went to go see the first group home, I said, well, we could do better than that, right? My family could do, I felt we could do a much better job at it. I felt that we could give more of a presence to it. And that's how we kind of started. I told my mom all about it. She thought it was a good idea. She wanted to continue working because she was retiring from the school district. And she said she wanted to continue helping kids, because she realized that it wasn't that kids had disabilities. It was generally emotional baggage that they were carrying of why they weren't attaining the information. And so her deriving from that situation, she said, yeah, I would love to, you know, run a home and help these kids out a little bit more. And that's how we kind of started off. It was me being a real estate, kind of investing and kind of looking at the big picture of the revenue. And then it was my mom with passionate that wanted to continue helping these kids. And then my business partner, Eugenia Wilson, which she handles the program, she was already working at the camp. She had graduated from San Diego State University. She was a deputy probation officer, and she worked at the juvenile camps in San Diego. And that's how the partnership formed.
Right. So all three of you, I guess, were making the connection in your own way.
Yeah.
Setting up a group home, I'm sure that had a lot of challenges that most of us cannot imagine, because it's not just the house and you're done. I mean, now you've got these people and they have all the challenges that they are carrying. What was that like?
Oh, wow. So you got to understand, young and being enthusiastic at the time. And you had to be a nonprofit. And so, of course, at 20 years old, 21, 22, right? I was like, usually nonprofits are for wealthy people that are, you know, being philanthropists, right? And so, long story short, it was really kind of a putting it together. Along with all of the others, since I was doing loan packaging, I was doing contracts anyway, I was like, oh, how hard could it be, right? And so unfortunately, right before we opened our group home, my mom got ill. And my thought was, well, I've only invested just a few thousand dollars, not a whole lot. How hard could it be to run a group home and take care of about six kids? And now, you know, we're 30 years later, like you said, it's been challenging because the bureaucracy involved, because of you think that everybody, you know, when you're in your 20s and 30s, you think everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to be saved. Everybody wants to get a good job or get a business and then what you call it, happy ever after. You think everybody wants that. And so, you know, no, like you said, everybody doesn't have that same fortitude. And what I think Living Advantage has done, and what I think what we're more proud of, is that You stick to it, right? Stick to it. And one day at a time, which we've done, and being there, being that foundation for our kids. We started doing virtual services and having a virtual community way before Facebook, you know, before Zuckerberg. I wish I was as smart as him, right? I mean, you know, who would know that it would be that it would be what it is today, social media. But, you know, I just my whole background, right, is business and solving problems. So I didn't go into it as a social worker, as an educator. I didn't go into it as a mental health provider. I went in it as a business. But when the first kid walked through our doors, I was like, oh, my God, has to be a better way to care for these kids. Mm-hmm. So my passion and my family background, my family are educators. They're educators. They're heavily into you know, serving God, serving the Lord. And so that mixture just rubbed off on me, of course. And so it was like, how can I better service these kids? Well, it has to be a better way. And so that's where my thoughts and my basis of what I bring to the table. And I felt that one of the things they didn't have was continuity. They didn't have, you know, continuity of services, and they didn't have a foundation. An average foster youth moves around in the system minimum of 7 times, up to 20 times, right? Secondly, they're behind in school. They're not at the same level as everyone. They don't graduate from high school. Only 40 some odd percent might graduate. And then if they're graduating, they're behind 1 or 2 years. Only out of the 40, I think it's 46% that graduate, only 3% actually go to college. Out of that 3%, only 1% actually graduate. So their education level is super low. So my thought again is, how can our kids get a better chance, a fair shake, right? How can they have a better quality of life? So what I go in and teach a kid is, you know, getting a job, find something you like, right? And then stick to it. Yes, sure, they definitely should graduate from high school. Sure, if they really want to go to college, absolutely, you know, let's set you up, you know, under the foster care, you know, rules and policies. Let's get you, you know, some secure housing. But bottom line, they have to be able to survive, and they have to be able to be independent. And that's what we teach our kids. We teach independence and fortitude. You know, you got to stick to it.
What does that program look like now? Because if you started with a group home for 6 kids, but today you've had a lot, I mean, hundreds of thousands passed through the program.
Absolutely.
In the last 3 decades. So what's the scope of the program today?
Sure. You know, very similar to the group home. So we had group homes for 12 years. And what we did was we traded the state contract, the county contract, into more of a public service. So now we have contracts with the LA Unified School District, Riverside School District, the probation department, and a couple other contracts. And it's specific to being able to provide educational and job skills, life skills to our kids. So we open it up to whereas what are their current needs now, and then how can they have sustainability, have a foundation, so they can have a sense of continuity wherever they leave off, they can pick up and keep starting and keep going. A lot of times when kids move around, they start all over again. A lot of times their vital life records don't follow them. So vital life records are their immunization shots. Is their photo ID, their birth certificates. These things don't follow them. So they literally, wherever they land for that time being, they have to start all over again and kind of repeat some of the stuff that they've done. Even their school records. If they're going to a whole different school district, who is going to be the one to get that information and have that follow them?
I'm glad you pointed that out, because for people who aren't familiar with this and what these kids are going through, those records are really vital, right? So immunization is one thing about whether or not they're going to be able to enter a new school because they have to be immunized to do so. Another is whether or not they've finished a certain class so they can take the next one. So it's not that the kids aren't capable or aren't interested necessarily. They may be both, but they can't necessarily take the class if there's no record they took the last one. They're not going to take advanced calculus if they didn't take geometry. That's a lot of paperwork. So a simple question, how young are the kids when they're starting to be touched by the programs that you offer? And then how do you help them kind of reconstruct the life when they're on the move like nomads?
Absolutely. On an average, we deal with kids as young as 12 when they're like starting junior high school. And then we have it's called the ELOC box. It's a patent pending trademark software application where we enter this information and then we're able to keep up with them. So let's say if they start out at 12, you know, they 15, 16, we generally, our goal is to make them understand or let them understand the importance. Again, now they have to also understand the importance of their records, the importance of their information, right? Once they understand that, then they upload it. We generally upload, our case managers upload it, and then we keep it for them. So now they have a history, they have a record, and then they can continue on. That's where that continuity part comes in at.
I'm thinking about how this even affects people in adulthood. So there's been a big conversation about voting. Forever, but especially since the 60s. But in the last few years, that conversation has focused a lot on these issues about records and whether or not you have the proper photo ID and other things. Yes. So it seems like after they go through this program, there are still these needs that probably emerge, or the confidence that they need to have reinstilled all the time. How do you and others continue to help them after, let's say, they've exited high school and it's time to move on, but they're still, like you said, maybe a couple years behind academically, certainly emotionally?
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the main things we do is continuously provide case management services, right? So when, let's say, a kid graduates from high school, he's not going to college because of the paperwork, right? The bureaucracy and trying to enroll in college, because they're usually trying to figure out where they're going to live. Out of the percentage of kids that actually have housing, transitional housing, it's only 15%. So you have an average in LA County, you have an average of about 3,000 kids that age out of the system, you know, give or take. Out of that 3,000, only 15% actually have transitional living. Only 15% of those kids have somewhere to live. So most of the kids are usually, you know, what they call it, couch surfing, living with relatives, kind of fending for themselves, homeless. You know, that's part where you get your homeless population. That's where kids end up in sex trafficking. That's why I think the statistic is 80% of our foster youth have been incarcerated. That's why such a high number of people that are incarcerated have been through foster care, because where else are they going to go? Usually they're trying to fend for themselves. So unfortunately they get caught up in stealing and, you know, the illegal ways that people survive on the streets. And so our job is that's why we constantly are. I appreciate you having me on your podcast, you know, livingadvantageinc.org. That's why it's so important that more people know about Living Advantage, so that they know where they can go to get support and services. It's really important that they know.
And this idea that people just need to know is something that's not alien to you either. So you've been this work for a long time. But when I talked to you before today, I remember you saying something really kind of hit me, which is that that this, you didn't even know these kinds of things existed yourself because you came from a strong family. So can you talk about that a bit? It's one thing to be working in it. It's another thing to be constantly kind of relearning, especially when you started as a very young person.
Yes. I'm going to give you the story of the first kid that walked through our doors. And I'm going to give you another story, literally 17 years after I opened my doors. The first kid that walked through our doors was a young Caucasian, blue-eyed. He was 12 years old. He came in with a bag and he walked in the door. First thing I said, well, where are your parents? And then I kind of had to stop. I said, well, where's the social worker? He just looked at me and said, oh, they drove off. Here's, you know, like he gave me like one sheet of paper. And so I literally, this was like our first opening, and you have this assessment that you have to fill out. And it's, oh my gosh, at least 3 or 4 pages. And you're asking questions of, you know, who is your social worker? What's their phone number? Where is the last place you live? You know, what's your birth date? You're asking this kid all of these things. And he's looking at me like a deer with the headlights. I mean, he started welling up in his eyes because he didn't know his birthday. He was like, I think it's on. He knew the date, but he didn't know the year. He kind of knew his age, but didn't. The piece of paper I had was just the transferring over to our group home. Had nothing to do with his personal background. He started tearing up. I started tearing up because I felt so bad. I didn't know that this is how the system was. I had no idea. So it's kind of a, you kind of learn as you go. And even if you are a social worker, even if, you know, you are a school teacher, unfortunately, at that time, my mom had passed on. She had passed. And she, actually, I'm sorry, she was really sick at that time. And so she wasn't there. When you're not from that environment or from that industry, you really don't know what these kids go through. And then they always make it seem like these kids are defiant and they're bad kids. They're victims. They're victims, and they're hurt, you know, sometimes physically and sometimes mentally, right? Emotionally hurt. And then they're lonely. Can you imagine being 12 years old and don't have a family member that's supporting you or there in your being? When I used to get in trouble, when I was a kid, it'd be my mom, my dad, my aunt, my uncle. It'd be everybody would be on my case. You know, I mean, I just had just a strong family background that I had no idea that this existed. We're going to go 17 years later. And it was me and a supporter. It was a donor. We're talking about living advantage and, you know, almost 2 decades that we're in this business and, you know, we're making such an impact with the kids. That's why we don't have group homes anymore, because now I service hundreds of kids a year. And you know, she's, you know, telling me, you know, great. I love to be a donor every month. And, you know, we're just going at it. And this curly head, very fair-skinned, green-eyed waiter. He was very, very jolly and young, good-looking guy. And I'm teasing him. I'm like, you know, asking him. So, and we're just talking in general. And I'm saying, so, you know, what nationality? Because we're talking about the kids. And I was thinking, like, you know, like this curly-haired, good-looking guy, you know, what nationality are you, right? Just to give an example was, you know, hey, this is, and he looks at me and says, oh, I don't know. I don't have a birth certificate. I'm in the foster care system. And it just, it totally dawned on me that our kids don't even know what nationalities they are. And it was just such a random, and literally, the supporter, which we're still really close friends today, the supporter jaw just dropped. Like, and then I'm looking at him like, see, my kids that would come through my doors, that was the first thing we did. First thing we did was got their birth certificate. We got their social security cards. We got them a photo ID. We did that sometimes before they even went to school. I didn't care. I'm not saying I didn't care about school. It was just that I needed my kids to have their information. So just in case something happened, at least they had that when they left Living Advantage. And so her jaw dropped. And then he started telling me, yeah, I never had a driver's license. I'm 23 years old, never drove before. I don't even have an eye. He just started telling my whole story to support. And you know, yes, we did get a big donation after that. But it was just so interesting. I was in this business for 17 years and never even thought, they don't even know their nationality.
The idea that a person doesn't know where they're from, like what their background story is, whatever that story might be, that's something where they probably almost have to create it from scratch. And it sounds like that's one of the things that maybe you're enabling them to do. It's not just gathering up papers. It's making up. It's creating from those things your own story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So even 30 years, I still learn a lot of how to better support and care for my kids. I learn a lot from my case managers, even my outreach coordinator, right? My communications director. I learn a lot because what they bring to the kids is a way that they can voice their opinions, that they can feel like they're important. Because the first thing I tell, I tell my case managers that you need to go in and find out what they want. We already know what they need. They need a roof over their head. They need to eat every day. They need to be hydrated. We know what they need, but what do they want? That's what I want you to go in and find out from them. And when they kind of change, instead of, oh, this is what we're going to do. Oh, you need to get your education. Oh, you need to be tutored. Find out what they want. Then it's so much easier to provide services to them.
There's an impression among the public, if there's any impression at all, of foster care as being kind of this strange bureaucratic system, almost Soviet style, where people are trying to go in and see people and they can't get an appointment, or if they do, it's very cold and it's procedural. It's not about the people, it's about the paperwork. And I don't know if any of that's true. I'm just saying that that's probably an impression we have from the media, from movies. But what I'm asking you here is, you're talking about casework in a way through the lens of a nonprofit organization, which you don't have to do this work. You get grants to do it and donors to help you, but it's a choice you're making. It's not something that's a requirement by law. You've been doing this a while, and you continue to see the problem, if anything, has magnified.
Yes.
So what keeps you doing it? What keeps the caseworkers working for you doing it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sometimes I wonder why. But you know why? Because I think like in the next, when I get off this podcast with you, I'm going to get that $1 million donor. And that's going to allow me to get a $200 million donor. And I'm going to save all of them. That's why. Every day I help more and more kids. I help more and more case managers, to know what's important, how you can change the life of this kid. We're going to have 1,000, foster youth, 1,000 probation, probation kids on our virtual workshop talking about financial literacy. And then our guest speaker is going to be Beyonce, and she's going to be on there for 4 minutes. And guess what? She's going to give them all the inspiration and motivation. And then they're going to be looking forward to the next week. And the President of the United States is going to be on, or John from the corner store, who has worked 40 years, but he's made a living and helped 3 generations of family. It's going to be about just providing these opportunities for the kids across the country to be able to know that they're loved, they're supported, that we're going to make sure that they have a foundation. The foundation is going to be all of us. It's going to be everybody, right? Because I know if you ask anybody, you line up 10 people and say, hey, wouldn't you like to support a foster youth? They're going to say, sure. How can I do it? And it'll be, Beyonce, I just need you on this Zoom call for 3 minutes. I just need you to give them the okay, right? Imagine that. They go back and tell their friends and how excited they'll be. Hey, you got to get on this Zoom call because, and then of course, then we're going to be, then the other, 57 minutes is going to be go to school, get a good grades. You know, make sure you're at, you know, you're supposed to be at work at 9 o'clock, you get there at 8:55, right? You know, those types of stuff that they don't want to hear, but it's important. So that's that. I think that's what keeps me going. That the next hour, that phone's going to ring, and that's going to be the person that's going to help, you know, help me with my kids. It's going to be easier.
Are you finding it to be easier not identify donors, but for donors to find you? That if a lot of this was through government contracts, which are great, because the need is real, and we could always use more government support. But a lot of what drives organizations like Living Advantage is private philanthropy. So yes. Are people finding you? How are you reaching out to them? What's the awareness level among people who could support your work?
Well, you know, we do several. So we do, you know, of course, we do nice podcasts like this. Our social media is not as robust as I would like it. We do PSAs, radio, TV. But you have to think about an average person has to have really a strong reason to donate, right? And they might be passionate about other, you know, other things besides foster youth or the purpose. So what we're doing is building the language, building the culture to, if you're passionate about art, Living Advantage is the place because our kids love art. If you're passionate about cancer and you want to, you know, help people, our foster youth have cancer. So this is a good place. So we just use the language and we open up the idea of why, you know, and then kids are our future, right? Kids are our future. If our kids are not going in a positive direction, then our future is going to go down the toilet with that. So again, there's all kinds of reasons of why people should donate and give it a thought to be able to be a little bit more proactive to, you know, over, you know, close to, you know, over a half a million kids in the country that can really make a difference in our lives.
Right. I've got to ask you again about your mom, because yes. you talked about how she came to this work and then you were drawn in, you know, bringing your kind of business lens to it. And then there you both were together for a short time, because I believe you lost her 3 years in after that yes. first group home. What do you think she would say about where the organization is now and where you're trying to take it?
I think she would be proud. She'd be proud, happy because we're doing the work every day. We get to meet with these kids. We're at the schools. We meet with sometimes hundreds of kids a day. You know, sometimes we have our little events and we get the kids to come in. They know more about what we do. We get to, you know, talk to them and, you know, find ways to, again, better support them. I think she would be proud and happy because coming from the Unified School District background, now we don't just have LA. Now we also have Riverside. You know, you have 2 caseworkers. Now we got 3 or 4 caseworkers. You know, we keep building. And I think, but we're building from a really strong state. It's not just a bunch of us, you know, working with, it's we're really making an impact to our kids. So I think that's what she'll be proud of and happy about. That is really, you know, giving them a way where they can, you know, attend school more, graduate, you know, be more, understand why it's important to show up at school and you know, participate.
And what are you most excited about as you're looking forward now?
You know, what's interesting is that, you know, I'm getting up there in age. And so we're developing a certain level of staffing that would allow me and my business partner to actually do other areas of the business to get more, you know, exposure. So we're allowing some of these young people to come in and do the jobs that we do right now, where we can go out, because of course we know a lot more of the philanthropists, and we know a lot more of the politicians. And so we're going to go out so we can get more exposure to be able to get more services for the kids.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Philanthropy Masterminds podcast. Thanks very much to our sponsor, DonorSearch, the world leader in fundraising intelligence, and of course, our producer, Jack Frost. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, the DonorSearch YouTube channel, or wherever you like to listen. And consider giving us a like and a positive review so others can find us too. Check out our live webinars and webcasts on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and come back next Friday for our next interview with another leader in the world of social good. Until then, this is Jay Frost. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.